Yo.
Okay.
What's up, guys?
Hey, how you doing, man?
So we started.
How's everything? Good to see you. What's up, guys? How you doing?
Some paper for you.
Cool. Fill in the blanks and multiple choice.
Ah.
There's one more. There's a map of Germany. Are there any maps of Germany left over?
Very nice.
We're going to learn how social democracy betrays.
Cindy, everything seems to stop.
Never again.
Is this a variation?
Here, let me check this out. I'm just telling you about it. It's all wrapped up like Salman is hot, but.
Interesting. I don't know this collection, but I know Santiago. Okay, why don't we get started? I just want to call everyone's attention. I put translations of the most important initials up there. As I talk, I'm generally going to use the initials, but just so everybody knows what they refer to. I don't know if we're going to really get to the Nazi seizure of power. If we do, it'll be at the end and rather schematically. But I just wanted to call your attention to the fact that Nazi in German comes from National Socialist German Workers' Party. It's really important to understand that the Nazis made real appeals to the working class, not very successfully, but they considered themselves to be a party that was for a workers' revolution, but a German workers' revolution. So, something that's often lost in translation when people just say Nazis or National Socialists. Okay. Cindy referred to what we're doing today as a lecture, and I corrected her to say that this is a discussion and presentation, and I really encourage people to ask questions as we go along, and hopefully I'll manage to cover this stuff in an hour and a half or two at the outside, and then we can really get into it. But feel free, if I make references to anything you don't understand, to just interrupt. Okay, the first thing, very generally, I made a map of Germany because some people may not be familiar with where all these different cities are. Now, as I said when I was handing it out, it's unfortunately in Spanish, but I think most people most of the spellings are pretty much the same. You notice, for example, that about one-fifth is now part of Poland. And before that, it was, it's essentially, it's been part of Poland since Poland reappeared on the map after World War I. And then over here is an even more, this is, I believe, still part of Russia, this area here. But at one point, and this is post-World War I, this was after Germany had given up territory, particularly in what's called this blank space here between Königsberg and the East, that was land that Germany had to give up after it surrendered in World War I. So Germany used to be a pretty large country. I mean, it still is. It's still the biggest country in Western Europe. But as I'm referring to cities, I'll occasionally point at this map. You notice that the map is basically, it's a map of religious affiliation in Germany. And we might think that's not terribly important for what we're talking about. But in fact, the difference between Protestant and Catholic in Germany is still very It's not like it was during the Reformation when people were burning each other and fighting wars and things like that. But still, there are areas that are very culturally Catholic and culturally Protestant. We have some material here. So there's a map, there's organizations, and are there any copies left of the sheet about affiliation, membership, things like that? I mean, I made 15. So
yeah,
you have one more? So okay. So let me just say a few sort of words of background. The first one thing I wanted to mention, for those of you who might find all this discussion of the teens and the 20s to be somewhat ancient history, several points. First of all, in order to understand the political spectrum of today, basically you have to have a roadmap. And the roadmap is historical. It's based on things that happened, in some cases, a long time ago, like Stalinism, for example. I mean, there aren't too many people today in the world who call themselves Stalinists, but there are plenty of people who are Stalinists, in my opinion, and to understand how that all came about, you have to understand where Stalin came from. You know, so it's come up in discussions before that people, you know, it's kind of a blur when, you know, what is the Spartacist League and what is the RCP and what are all these different Maoist and Trotskyist groups and what are these anarchist groups and so on. And they generally tend to have historical affiliation. So that's one important reason to sort of understand this background. The second thing is I wanted to point out some very interesting parallels between Germany in the period we're talking about and China today. And this is not just something I made up. excuse me? In China, in various think tanks, all kinds of people are studying exactly the stuff we're studying and earlier German history in order to understand better what parallels and differences there are, because Germany 120 years ago was a rising power challenging the power of France, England, and the United States, and today China is a rising power challenging the power of the United States. And the parallels continue. That China is full of, you know, I don't know exactly how many, but probably 200 million workers, and you know, who become more and more active and combative. And in the same way, since we talked about the theory of permanent revolution before, in the same way that Germany was the weak link of the world capitalist system, above all in 1848, Russia was the weak link in 1905 and 1917, I would say one could argue that China is the weak link today. That is, it's a place where capitalism is really emerging very powerfully, and at the same time, the country has to adapt itself to its new role in the world market. We can talk about this towards the end, because to me it's one of the most important aspects of you know, why this stuff is really still alive as historical questions. Okay, now I just want to go into a little background about German history in order to make clearer what an unusual country it was in the period we're talking about. Now, I didn't make a map of Europe as a whole, but with imagination we can conjure it up. Germany started, as you'll see in a minute, German history was a series of disasters and misfortunes. It was one of the reasons that kind of shaped it. You know, today, or until recently, anytime anyone wrote a book about German history, the question in the background, whether it was about the 13th century or the 19th century, was always, why did Nazism happen in Germany? It's kind of like with Russia. You can't pick up a history book about Russia, whether it's talking about Peter the Great or Catherine the Great, and where the question is not somehow posed, you know, why did, you know, Russia go the way it went? Well, but one of the answers to that question is that, first of all, Germany's geographical location, it's right in the middle of Europe, and it has no real natural boundaries of defense. So armies from other countries were rolling over Germany all the time. But back before, before the Reformation, before the rise of Protestantism, which was in some sense the beginning of a kind of bourgeois revolution in Germany, Germany was one of the richest parts of Europe. This was before the North Atlantic became important, before the Spanish and Portuguese and other voyages that developed slave trade and made shifted the whole balance of the European economy away from the center. And the real center was between Germany and Italy, and trade was going north and south. By the 17th century, that Germany had become something of a backwater. And in fact, so had Italy, because then France and Britain and the North Atlantic kind of replaced them. So that's, you know, the first bad thing that happened to Germany. Then in 1525, or in the early 1520s, the Protestant Reformation took off. And the Protestant Reformation struck a real chord in Germany, probably more than anywhere else. You know, Martin Luther and his famous 95 Theses, and the way in which large parts of the German population rallied to Luther, you know, for all kinds of reasons. It generally didn't have that much to do with religion as such, but, you know, people were just sick of being exploited by the Catholic Church and having to pay tithes and having to pay for births and funerals and having to have everything mediated through a priest who spoke Latin. You know, one of the most important things Luther did was translate the Bible into German so people could really know what it was about. And it all started nicely from Luther's point of view, but pretty soon it got out of hand, and there was a peasant uprising in large parts of Germany. It was very radical. And one of the most important figures in this was a guy named Thomas Münzer, who was kind of a hero, and rightly so, in Marxist history. I mean, all through the history of the East Germany, the German Democratic Republic, and there was a 300-foot-high statue of Thomas Münzer somewhere,
During the Weimar? During Weimar, there was a Thomas Münzer statue?
I don't know if it's still there.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, we probably bombed it.
Right. Right. And I forgot to mention, by the way, let's be clear on this, too. When I say Germany, at this time and for many years afterwards, Germany was really a linguistic expression, and it was incredibly disunited. And it was in the interest of all the major European powers to keep it disunited, which was another one of its, shall we say, misfortunes. So the peasants revolted and scared the hell out of the landlords, and the peasant wars took place. Frederick Engels wrote a great book called The Peasant Wars in Germany, which I highly recommend as probably more insightful about German history than 100 books by academics you might come across. And the forces opposed, the peasants, of course, were poorly armed. They had no military training. They had pitchforks and staves and things like that. And they were opposed by the knights. they greatly outnumbered the knights. But to show the limits of the kind of revolutionary ideology, Marx and Engels said Münzer was a communist who came 300 years before his time. At the key moments in battles, the peasants would stop and wait for a sign from heaven telling them what to do next, and then they would be slaughtered by the knights. So in a relatively short time, all of the peasant uprisings were put down. And the result was, and for hundreds of years, this kind of conservative, very servile ideology that survived in the German peasantry that made it rather different from some other peasantries that actually rose up and won, like in France or earlier in England. Okay, the next misfortune was something called the 30 Years' War, which was fought from 1618 to 1648. And as I said, Germany was completely disunited at this time, and most of the different small kingdoms and so on were not directly involved in the war. It was just that because of this problem of no natural boundaries, the war was completely fought on German soil for 30 years with plundering, looting, Catholic, oh, and by the way, this, of course, was a Reformation war, Catholic armies against Protestant armies, huge battles. And at that time, not that it's changed so much, but at that time, soldiers didn't really get paid. They just looted. So the winning side tended to just cart off all the crops and anything else of value in the areas that were captured. This went on for 30 years, and when it ended, one-third of the population of Germany had been killed or had died from plagues and so on. So that was what really finished off Germany as an economic power for the German area for 200 years. It was just recovering. There were totally abandoned small towns and villages, wolves running in the street. I mean, it was just absolute desolation after, you know, it was truly the four horsemen of the apocalypse. So the next thing that happened was the French Revolution. That was in 1789, and 10 years later, Napoleon took power and conquered all of Germany and, you know, extended into Russia. And that is an interesting episode because, in fact, Napoleon, it was kind of like when the Red Army moved into Eastern Europe in 1945, in spite of being Stalinists and everything else you want to care to mention, they carried out serious land reform. And Napoleon did something of the same thing. I mean, Napoleon, actually in Western Germany, which was always in the cultural sphere of France, Napoleon is remembered rather favorably because he broke the power of some of the old feudal landlord classes. And that power was never really completely restored. But when Napoleon was finally defeated, Germany and Central Europe sank into a period of deep reaction, which lasted for over 30 years, from 1815 to 1848, so it was about 25 years. And this time, you know, Russia and the different major parts of Germany and down here in the southeast, the Austrian Empire, the Habsburg Empire, was the most powerful empire in Europe at the time. Those three powers conspired to enforce a counter-revolutionary kind of repression of everything, you know, from education to the kinds of books that got published, and not to mention, of course, political repression. So there was this long winter that continued in the 1840s that was finally broken by the next misfortune in German history, which was the Revolution of 1848. Now, one of the things I want to emphasize in this presentation is the way in which, I mean, what Marx and Marxists generally always wrote about Germany was that the bourgeoisie came too late. The bourgeois revolution had happened in England, it had happened in France, but when the German bourgeoisie, which was never terribly courageous, was ready to really try to get political power, the German economy had already created a significant working class, or let's just say a wage labor class in cities and towns that could challenge it from the left. And that's what happened in 1848, that suddenly, you know, it starts out with the usual liberal phrases, but soon red flags were appearing in demonstrations, confrontations, and as Engels points out in another very good book that I recommend called Revolution and Counter-Revolution in Germany, those two books will give you an excellent overview of the whole development of German history. The bourgeoisie recoiled and basically sort of started to make peace with the status quo. In that time, you know, the most important part of the status quo was the Emperor of Prussia. Prussia being this large eastern area of Germany that had a very large Junker class, J-U-N-K-E-R. Those were feudal landlords. By that time, of course, agriculture had been partially capitalized. They were producing for the world market, but still the kind of social structure and relations and mores, that cultural ambience was still very feudal. And so those three powers, it was actually called the Tripartite Alliance, the Holy Alliance, sorry, Russia, Prussia, and Austria, maintaining a stranglehold on all of European politics. There was a liberal uprising in Spain in 1832, and French armies invaded to put it down under the pressure of the Holy Alliance. That's how totally they had the situation locked up. Okay, so as you see that Germany really had a problem having a real bourgeois revolution, even as it became capitalist. So the next disaster was the unification of the country. That was carried out by Bismarck. I'm sure most of you have heard of Bismarck. Bismarck himself was a Junker, very skillful politician. And at that time, you know, the bourgeoisie had been trying to unify the country because that's what the bourgeoisie does. The bourgeoisie builds a nation state. And their conception was what was called the large German solution, which means that it would include lots of land that was part of the Austrian Empire. And their idea was with Austria and the German lands together, Prussia would be isolated and the country would be, you know, liberalism would be more possible. Well, Bismarck very skillfully isolated the liberals and unified the country under what was called the small German solution, which meant excluding all the Austrian lands. And he did this by a series of wars in the 1860s. Bismarck, for example, studied the Civil War in the United States. And he was very interested in the use of railroads and machine guns in modern, you know, because they were unknown at that time in warfare in Europe. So he had a real world perspective, and he unified the country through three wars from 1862 to 1870. Now, the last war was the Franco-Prussian War, in which Germany defeated France and set the stage for the Paris Commune. The entire Paris Commune took place with the German army just right outside of Paris in case things got out of hand. The French reactionary forces weren't able to handle it. And significantly, the German socialists who were about to form the German SPD a few years later opposed the war from an internationalist point of view. They said no German soldier should die for this, you know, imperial, whatever word they used, war against France. It was, I think, the last time that ever happened, as we shall see. Okay, so again and again, what could be called the progressive bourgeois forces were stopped in their tracks, defeated, stymied, and so on. And so Germany emerged as a capitalist power, but without a real bourgeois democracy. It was an extremely authoritarian modern country with the Junker class sharing power with and really dominating politically the bourgeoisie. I won't go into details, but there were many key confrontations where the Junkers just put the bourgeoisie in its place. and ran the country in order to preserve their power in this large eastern agricultural zone. And it was only when the Red Army occupied eastern Germany in 1945 that these people were finally expropriated. Okay, now we can get into the current subject. But I think this background is important because one of the questions that's come up before is why was there no revolutionary party in Germany comparable to the Bolsheviks? And I think one of the important things you can see from all the stuff that I just mentioned is how the country remained highly decentralized even when it had this authoritarian Prussian regime in Berlin. The Prussia was, there were four or five other poles of power that even after unification, after they'd been defeated by Bismarck politically or sometimes militarily, it just wasn't quite a command economy in the way that the Soviet Union became with Stalinism. So, yeah, we've covered a lot of ground before, particularly in the first meeting about Rosa Luxemburg and Lenin. And so I'm not going to go over all of that again, of course, drive everybody crazy. But I do want to mention just a couple of things to keep in mind. One of the things that makes Germany so interesting, even today, today Germany is China's number one industrial trading partner. As I said, Chinese academics and advisors are studying the German case, not just historically, but also today, because, for example, Germany, after World War II, introduced a very modernized set of labor relations in which they allowed, I think it's right in the Constitution, allowed for works councils in factories, not workers' councils, not Soviets running the factories, but works councils, which mean that the workers get some seats on the board of directors and sort of have some say. Some factories, for example, that would have been moved to lower wage countries, stayed in Germany because of the pressure of these works councils. It's a murky situation, and I'm not meaning to imply that Germany, workers in Germany, they certainly have more power than in the United States. And so China is very interested, for example, with all the labor unrest that they've got. Maybe we should have some work councils. Maybe we should make workers co-responsible for managing what's going on. So, getting back to why is Germany so important and why was it so important? In some sense, all the ideologies of the 20th century came out of Germany. Communism, Marx, fascism, which, the forces that led to the Nazi seizure of power. I mean, there were ideologies in other countries as well that Mussolini took power 11 years before Hitler, but nonetheless, Germany really put fascism on the map globally. The welfare state, Bismarck was a pioneer of the welfare state, starting in the 1880s, the rising socialist movement, all these militant workers, this is getting out of hand. He created old age insurance, health insurance, and other kinds of benefits that we associate with the modern, the quickly disappearing modern capitalist state. These were innovated by Bismarck. Corporatism, that is, there's a different kind of idea that, workers and peasants and capitalists together should manage society in some way, was also pretty much a German creation. So,
I thought it was Mussolini that actually came up with corporatism, and his doctrine.
He may have been the first one, to use it, but there are German predecessors. There are predecessors elsewhere, too. I mean, the Catholic Church was really into corporatism long before there ever was any real corporatism. But Germany had, LaSalle, who we talked about last week or the week before. I mean, he was essentially a corporatist. He wanted, to him, socialism meant all workers having cooperatives, and revolution wasn't even really necessary to bring that about. Okay, so just to hit the highlights of a couple of things we've talked about before. The Second International was international. The First International collapsed in the 1870s because of the Marx-anarchism confrontation. The Second International was founded in 1889, and by the early 1900s, there were large parties calling themselves socialist in Germany, the SPD, France, French Socialist Party, the British Labour Party, which got going in 1906. These were all parts of this Second International. But one thing, and this is very important, the Second International was nothing like the Third International. There was, even with the prestige of Germany, which, you know, after all, that's where all this Marxist theory came from. Karl Kautsky was viewed as kind of the pope of Marxism at this time. I mean, he really kind of ruled about what was acceptable and what was orthodox and what wasn't. The idea of the German party telling the French party what to do or imposing discipline on some other foreign party for its own political purposes, as the communist government in Russia did starting in the 1920s, was unthinkable. It was a much looser association. Now, Bismarck fell in 1890. He'd been in power for over 30 years, and he fell essentially because people at the top of the German government saw that the working class was getting out of control, and Bismarck had banned the socialists, anti-socialist laws in 1878 for 12 years. It wasn't quite, you know, they weren't wiped off the map. They were still allowed to participate in elections, things like that, but they were highly restricted in terms of meetings, publications. They were producing all kinds of books and pamphlets in Switzerland and smuggling them into the country. But by the time Bismarck fell, the SPD had become a major force in the German parliament. You know, not a majority by any means, but still, you know, it was becoming the largest single party. And so they felt that Bismarck was getting old. They felt it was time for, new faces, kind of like bringing in Obama right after the crisis in 2008 or something like that. a facelift on the political class. we talked our first meeting about the revisionism debate. And this, again, is an important development that goes on through this whole period, the rise of people who are saying, this Marxist stuff, let's forget about it, it's just too apocalyptic, it's always talking about the final crisis of capitalism, and we see the German working class is living better every year, and what crisis, and this was articulated by several leading party figures, and they were very heavily put down by Rosa Luxemburg and also by Kautsky. Kautsky was the keeper of orthodoxy. But what was developing, and I want to go into this a little more, what was developing was essentially three different currents in the German working class movement. There were was the left, Rosa Luxemburg. Her pamphlet, The Mass Strike, expressed probably better than anything else I could think of, the way in which party apparatuses, she never says they're not necessary, but she does say that they do not declare mass movements, and they do not bring them into existence. They can intervene in them, guide them, and so on, but, as she puts it, the mistakes of a genuine mass movement in motion are better than the wisest decisions of the most intelligent central committee. This is what really got Lenin and the Bolsheviks all worked up and, starting to attack Rosa as a spontaneous and so on. Then there was the center that was headed by Kautsky, the orthodoxy, and Luxemburg and Kautsky began to fall out around 1910. And that was at that point that, well, let me just talk about what was happening on the right. The right was centered in the trade union bureaucracy. And even though at every party congress, the left and the Kautsky center always won the debates, you know, voting for, we're Orthodox Marxists, we believe in socialism, we believe in revolution. You know, in reality, in the daily practice of the SPD, the conservatism of the trade union bureaucrats was getting more and more influential. And by 1910, Rosa had had it with Kautsky. And this is important for contemporary debates. If you ever have to deal with any Trotskyists, they always say, Rosa Luxemburg should have founded a vanguard party just like Lenin did. Well, in fact, Lenin, right up to 1914, still looked at Kautsky as the most important Marxist in Europe. And as I mentioned, I think the first week, you know, he couldn't believe it when the German SPD voted for war credits for Germany in August of 1914. He thought the newspapers were fakes produced by the police. And so here's Rosa, who had seen that Kautsky, you know, had resigned from the revolutionary movement 4 years before Lenin, and yet Leninists today are still banging away about how, you know, Rosa should have formed a vanguard party. Now, this is, you know, this is a very complicated question. Why wasn't there a push for an independent revolutionary party? Because Rosa, by this time, had no illusions about the SPD. And for those of you who looked at some of the readings I sent out, already in 1908 in Holland, there was a small group of people who are effectively left communists who broke with Dutch social democracy and set up their own party. Now, as far as I know, they never became more than 500 or 1,000 people until World War I. But they were some of the most talented people in the Dutch movement, and the Dutch working class was very militant. If you read the Bourinet stuff, the stuff that I sent out the second time, I mean, there were militant mass strikes going on in Holland from 1902, 1903 on, right up to World War I. And these three figures, Herman Goerder, Anton Pannekoek, and Henrietta Roland Holst, these were, you know, very serious theoreticians. Pannekoek entered the mass strike debate with some articles in 1909 that Lenin thought very highly of. As a matter of fact, all references to Pannekoek in Lenin's writings up until after the Russian Revolution are very positive. I mean, he thought Pannekoek...
Though, he's mentioned in Infantile Disorder, though, right?
Oh, yeah. Like, well, that's after.
Okay.
You know, I mean, and by the way, let's not overlook the fact that Pannekoek's writings were also very influential in the United States. In the left wing of the Socialist Party, there were, you know, the International Socialist Review, not to be confused with the current publication of the ISO, was read in 20 or 30 different languages, and some great articles by Pannekoek. There were Latvian workers up in Boston and Finnish workers out in Minnesota who were deeply influenced by Pannekoek's mass strike perspective. And when the Communist Party was founded in the United States in 1919, they had a hell of a time of winning these people over to the Moscow line because they were such, you know, hard, you know, left communist mass strike theoreticians. So, you know, Pannekoek had very wide influence. And Herman Goerder's influence came a little later. Henrietta Roland Holst, she was less radical. She kind of oriented toward the center to some extent. And by the way, these people were all famous artists and scientists, which is another interesting point that, you know, we would be kind of surprised today if an astronomer like Pannekoek wound up as the theoretician of one of the most radical wings of the movement, or if a poet like Herman Goerder, I mean, Herman Goerder's most important poem is still read in Dutch schools today as the national poem. It's kind of like Melville in America or something like that. You know, these literary and scientific people having such prestige. Well, probably the reason for that, similar to things we've talked about with the Bolsheviks, is that there, at that time there was a very significant gap between the small minority of educated people, people with kind of high bourgeois culture, and the mass of workers. And the best of them tried to hook up with the working class movement in whatever way they could. And it's just the case of Panikkar, for example, and Gorder, very successfully. Panikkar traveled all over Germany before World War I and was teaching in different party schools with Rosa Luxemburg. They were actually very close. And this brings me to another important point for the revolution itself. You notice up here in northwestern Germany, the cities of Hamburg and Bremen. Well, those were ports that were open to the world in a way that most cities in Germany, which were landlocked, were not. And therefore, they were always kind of more liberal in the bourgeois sense and more radical in the working class sense than almost any other city except for Berlin. And this is where Panikkar and Gorder had their biggest influence. So I'll come back to that momentarily. Okay, so the war starts in 1914. The SPD collapses along with all the other major parties of the Second International, except for the Serbians, the Italians, and the Americans, who wind up opposing entry by their own country into the war. Another significant episode is the mass demonstrations. I mean, this is just something that should indicate the limits of mass demonstrations all over Europe against the war in the last days of July 1914. And Rosa Luxemburg was on the platform in front of 200,000 or 300,000 people, I believe, in Brussels, and she fainted on the platform. And she said, I know that in 2 or 3 days, all of these countries are going to vote to enter the war on the side of their bourgeoisie, and that most of these people will go along with it. And this is another thing, not to get off too many tangents, but people in 1914 had no idea what modern warfare was about. The only really modern wars had been the U.S. Civil War and the very brief Franco-Prussian War in 1870, which lasted a couple of months. And no one imagined the firepower of modern artillery, the use of machine guns. Airplanes had not yet really begun to be used for military purposes, but it was just, there was a kind of festive, there was a festive atmosphere all over Europe. People were just kind of bored by bourgeois society. And, when the war was declared, everyone just thought it was a great adventure. Almost everyone imagined that the war would be over by Christmas time. This is in August. And, for example, the French army marched off to the front against the German army with the officers wearing extremely colorful uniforms with big feathers and on horseback with sabers. it was just this kind of unreality about what was about to happen. And what did actually happen, as you know, was this meat grinder of 4 years in which 50,000 people would be killed and captured two miles of the front. And then the next day, the other army would charge back and recapture that, and another 50,000 people would be killed. And this just went on and on. The front essentially ran from all along the border of Germany, from Belgium down to Switzerland. And then, of course, there was further fighting in the east, but not so much trench warfare. So the populations and the political parties were just totally unprepared for what happened. And as we discussed the first meeting, these little minorities of people, Rosa Luxemburg, Lenin, the Dutch Council of Communists, a few people in France, a few people in Britain, you know, kept their heads, opposed the war, but you know, they would risk their lives going out into these celebrating crowds to try to agitate against the war. Now, this changed over time. You know, you may have heard some bourgeois liberal professor say, well, World War I showed that nationalism is much more powerful than Marxism. Look what happened in August 1914. Well, just look what happened a few years later, as the reality of the slaughter and the meaninglessness of the slaughter, you know, had really set in. I mean, it's, you know, I'll just highlight a couple of episodes that sort of show that. Starting in late 1916, for example, the German army mutinied, Navy mutinied up here in Kiel, which was the main port from which the German Navy never was anything nearly as powerful as the British Navy, but some bright-eyed admiral decided to send the whole fleet out to fight the British Navy, which was blockading the country relatively late in the war, and the sailors mutinied and took over all the ships and took over Kiel, and this was a real warning shot. to you know, all the party, to everybody who was, you know, watching what was going on. In early 1917, a French general named Neville decided to launch an offensive on the Western Front, you know, where everything was bogged down, and it was such a slaughter that, again, there was a massive mutiny, and special divisions of the French army had to be brought in from all over the place to put it down. And the repression was so great that to this day, the government archives on what happened in that mutiny have never been opened. You cannot see; no one can see them except maybe some, you know, high, you know, somebody with high connections in the military. So, you know, more and more, you know, the peace, the social peace that had been established at the beginning was breaking down all over the place. And that's when these different forces go into motion. Okay, I mentioned briefly the Dutch left, and the Dutch left is kind of a misnomer. It's really the German Dutch left, with this great influence that Pannekoek, Gorder, and others had up here in these very militant Northwest working class areas. The Russian Revolution. Just the February Revolution, when the Tsar was overthrown, was another thing that radicalized the situation. And very interestingly, in the United States, Woodrow Wilson, who was president, was watching all this very carefully. And the famous 14 points that you probably heard about in a high school civic class or something like that, they were issued as a direct response to the Bolshevik Revolution, because Wilson realized that it was a war of propaganda between the bourgeois Western powers and the new Russian Revolution that had just taken power. So there's a big whole geopolitical element to it. The United States Army intervened in the war in the spring of 1917 and began to turn the tide. And this is also important for understanding the revolution and what happened. Up until, even after the U.S. intervened, it really looked like Germany was winning the war. We talked about, because it was last time, the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, which the Bolsheviks signed under duress in early 1980, or didn't sign, but I guess they did finally sign. But in any case, they gave away like 1/4 of all Russian territory to Germany and Austria. So on the eastern, and this allowed Germany to start moving troops to the Western Front. And so things are looking pretty good. And the lines were all holding on the Western Front. pretty much. Nevertheless, in September of 1918, with all of these riots and strikes beginning to really accelerate, the high levels of the German general staff looked at the situation and they just decided, it's all over. We've got to surrender. or we've got to surrender on the best terms possible, and thinking that they would get maybe peace without annexations or something like that.
Lauren, I have a quick question.
Yeah.
So a lot of times when you look at bourgeois histories, the decision to surrender in wars makes it look like it's just based on external situations, but the kind of maybe the implicit thing of this, the presentation you're putting out is that they're also considering the internal dynamics of their countries of whether they will be overthrown themselves, hence all the mutinies and whatnot. So
sure.
That's definitely a dynamic in how long to fight, when to surrender.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I mean, there's always the question of the internal politics of all the countries involved in war. I mean, in the United States, as Woodrow Wilson was intervening, I understand some of you watched the Warren Beatty film Reds the other night. Well, you know that Wilson got reelected in 1916 on the slogan, "He kept us out of war." And a few months later, he declared war on Germany. and from 1917 to 1920, the U.S. government was repressing the IWW, pretty much unprecedented levels of repression, with thousands of people jailed, lynchings, IWW offices being burned down and shut down by people's militias, or, essentially middle-class people. so there was a very acute awareness of the explosive nature of the internal situation in the United States as the U.S. entered the war, because there was a lot of opposition to the war as well. And the British and the Americans, above all, were watching the situation in Germany very carefully. I mean, because, they knew about... There were strikes going on in Britain as well, and they knew that the German working class had these militant traditions and that after the war, anything could happen. As a matter of fact, Germany was under blockade during the war. The blockade was maintained for a year or two after the war ended. Why? Because they were controlling food shipments to keep revolution under control. And hungry, starving people tend to go into the streets and make revolutions. And in Austria, the monarchy had been overthrown exactly for that reason. In Hungary, there was a revolution. They didn't actually take power until 1919, but the Allies knew, the Allies being France, the United States, and Britain, they knew that they had to deal with the internal situation in all these countries that were in the process of surrendering, because they saw what happened in Russia. Okay, so now we get into some very complicated stuff, and I haven't really thought too much about the German Revolution for a very long time until people expressed interest in talking about it here. So I spent a lot of time over the last week kind of reviewing and putting together the stuff, and looking at it, to me, it really, at some level, appears as kind of a blur. So I'm sure those of you who are hearing about it for the first time or reading about it for the first time also experiencing it as something of a blur. I sent out two books to everybody who was on the list. And by the way, anyone who didn't get the notices, please talk to me afterwards so I can put you on the list for further emailings. But the book by Jean Barrault, which was Dauvet's pseudonym back in the 1970s, by Jean Barrault and Denis Autier on the German communist left, is a good source. I'll talk about it a little later. I have my doubts about some of it. Some of the people I know in Paris really hate that book for what might appear to be sectarian reasons. But the book, the second book I sent out by Philippe Bourinet on the, what is it called? I think it's called the German and Dutch Communist Left, I think is more reliable. But I'll get to that. Those are X, Y, and Z kinds of considerations. Let me just try to touch on the A, B, and C. Yeah. Anybody? So Germany surrenders, and the German emperor, the Kaiser, flees to Holland. And crowds pour into the downtown areas of all the major cities, and above all, Berlin. I think I mentioned the first week that just to show where the working class was politically and in terms of consciousness, with 1 million people on the main downtown square of Berlin on the day the Kaiser left, at one end were the Social Democrats who were getting ready to crush the revolution by arms, if necessary, proclaiming the German Republic. And at the other end were Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht, the two best-known anti-war agitators who had spent most of the war in jail, announcing the creation of the German Soviet Republic, and there were wild cheers at both ends of the square. there was a lot of confusion about what was going on, and the way in which Germany had collapsed, even though there's no question that in their personal communications that top German commanders had said, hey, this is all over, this legend arose that became known as the stab in the back legend, that Germany was winning the war and that it was the Jews and the socialists who had knifed the whole thing. And this persisted. This was a major myth in the rise of Nazism. so crowds pour into the downtown areas of main cities, and all over Germany there are workers, soldiers, and sailors' councils, and red flags flying everywhere, and the army just being essentially demobilized on both fronts. But it's important not to fetishize these councils, because a lot of them were not revolutionary. And this came, this became clearer in the course of the events from 1918 onward, that just because people set up Soviets and workers' councils doesn't necessarily mean that they're ready to have a communist revolution. And this was one of the problems that Rosa Luxemburg and Liebknecht had in dealing with the situation. They were not totally aware of this. Because it was, of course, it was dazzling. You know, here's the German Kaiser who had ruled the dynasty that had ruled for 350 years, packing up and leaving town. Now let me just back up briefly to explain the political developments during the war. If you looked at either one of those books or the short article by Bourinet on the German Communist Left, we know the broad outlines that during the war, the anti-war sentiment in the Social Democratic Party became quite significant. And in early 1917, a large minority was booted out of the party for disloyalty to the war effort. And they founded this USPD, the Independent Social Democratic Party of Germany. I'll just refer to it from now on as USPD. And these included Kautsky and Bernstein, who was the theoretician of revisionism. All the center politicians left with the USPD, as did Rosa and Liebknecht and other leaders of the hard left. But very quickly it was obvious that they were incompatible, and within a year, shortly before the war had ended, the the left constituted itself as the Spartacus Bund, the Spartacist League, but I'll call it the Spartacus Bund to avoid confusion with the contemporary Spartacist League. they were a minority. Probably in all of Germany, they had 500,000 followers, whereas the USPD had about 5 million followers, and the Social Democratic, the true conservative or reformist Social Democrats had about 6 million followers. This I'm talking about as it turned out in the first elections after the war. And then within the Spartacus Bund, there was already a split underway. And that's the far left may not be brilliant in making revolutions, but it is brilliant in developing splits. And this tension arose even before the collapse of the government and the German military surrender between Rosa's faction. And Rosa, of course, was in jail almost all this time. But the people in the who founded the Spartacus Bund with the so-called IKD, which were the left communists up here, that's the independent communists of Germany, international communists of Germany, and their real base was up here in these radical cities, Bremen, Hamburg, and elsewhere. Now, another really interesting aspect of this whole development was with these people known as the revolutionary shop stewards, and they were centered in Berlin. And they were sympathizers of the Spartacus Bund early on. They were against the war. They met almost every night for some time during the war. They were coordinating actions in the underground around Berlin and in some other key cities. And they were totally won over to the Spartacus Bund.
I had a quick clarifying question. According to this map, is the the Spartacus, the IKD, and I forgot how to say this.
Left radicals?
Yes. Are they all still part of the USPD as tendencies, as fractions?
Yes.
So they're not independent groups at this point?
Not yet, but as you see, then they all... by the way, I want to ask you... explain that while I was photocopying this, this side over here got cut off, but these are basically the syndicalist forces that were constituting different kinds of unions or direct action workers groups and things like that. And I frankly don't know that much about them. And for the narrative I'm developing, I don't think they're terribly important. So I apologize for that. But sorry?
The FAUD.
Yeah, FAUD, and then other groups that moved in and out of the far left during the key years from 1918 to 1921,
23. So in your presentation, are you going to try to... I'm wondering if you're going to go into a little bit about how... I know Rosa's concern was not forming a sect or becoming isolated from the working class, so she was always trying to navigate a relation... pretty complex relationship to the USPD,
right,
which when you read Trotsky's histories, they kind of slam her hard because they're like, she didn't break with the USPD and
right,
ended up muddling a clear organizational position.
Right.
Okay.
Well, that is true. Rosa felt very strongly the need her friends, she was very friendly with the Dutch ultra-left people, and particularly with Henriette Rolland-Holst, who kept saying, Rosa, what are you doing in that rotten reformist party? Why don't you break out and start your own group? And she said, better to be part of a muddled reformist mass group than to be a small sect on the sidelines. That was her attitude, and that is why she continued after the collapse of, after the revolution, so to speak. And by the way, the first head of state after the Kaiser left was Ebert, who was one of the key right-wing socialists. I mean, the situation was so dire that the only people they could think of to put in power after the Kaiser left was the SPD. And I should mention that for a year before that, German military had been in contact with the right wing of the SPD preparing for this situation. There was something called the Gruner-Scheidemann Pact. Scheidemann was another wretched right-wing SPD politician. Gruner was a German general, and they worked out a deal that, you know, the Kaiser goes, the SPD will take power, and the military will support the right wing. So everything kind of fell into place, such as it was.
The IKD, it's a split from the Spartacus?
I was just about to get to that. Okay. But yes, yeah. I mean, those are the hardcore followers of Panikuk and Gorder up in those northwestern cities. And they gave Rosa a hard time also about not breaking immediately with the USPD. You know, they later, when the split finally happened, this was after Rosa was killed and the Communist Party affiliated with the USPD to form a new mass party. You know, the IKD people said they'd rather have 5 million wretched reformist left-wing social democrats than to have 50,000 hardcore revolutionary workers. And that certainly is not how Luxembourg imagined it, but that kind of was the result of her policy.
And then their class composition was, they were mostly sailors, or, you know?
No, I think, well, yeah, I mean, clearly they were, you know, they were longshoremen, okay, and other people connected to the ports, but I think also some, you know, important industrial workers as well. But clearly the atmosphere of the port, the constant interaction with foreign influences and things like that were one of the reasons why those cities were more open and more radical than some of the cities in the heartland. Okay, so the right wing of the SPD takes power with the support of the military. And given that it's a revolutionary or a proto-revolutionary situation, they had to move very carefully, because here are all these people out in the streets waving red flags and talking about the establishment of a German Soviet republic. And so very quickly, I put these two guys, the villains of the piece, Gustav Noske and Friedrich Ebert, who I just mentioned. Ebert is now the head of state. Noske is key in mobilizing this group called the Freikorps. Freikorps just were, you know, it's kind of like the French Foreign Legion. I mean, these were people who had spent the entire war in the trenches, very battle-hardened, very reactionary, and they were pulled off of the fronts fighting against the Bolsheviks and the worker uprisings that were going on in Finland and in the Baltic countries and in the western part of Russia. there's a really remarkable book, a bit long, a bit flavored by postmodernist language, but really remarkable, called Male Fantasies. I can't remember the author's name, but you can find it under that title. And this guy goes through the diaries and newspapers and somehow gets transcripts of the dreams of these Freikorps people. And it's filled with, I mean, just, of course, anti-Semitism, but that was the least of it. What they were really into was incredible misogyny. and Jewish communist women were to them, you know, I mean, Rosa Luxemburg was the symbol of of everything they despised, and they reveled in capturing and killing communists, executing them, but they were particularly vengeful and violent with women communists that they captured. So these were not nice people. And there were tens of thousands of them, and they were brought into Berlin by the Social Democrats. I mean, this is something that at the time, again, we have to remember, you know, we look back on, you know, world wars, massacres, and things like that as not something that we relish, but we were kind of used to that kind of catastrophe. What, at this time, all of after 100 years of relative peace, a peaceful development of capitalism and so on, you know, this was just all so completely new. And so the Pride Corps came into Berlin, and street fighting started in January 1919. The KPD was founded at the very end of 1918 by these two factions. And Rosa Luxemburg and the people around her, who were the leaders of the party, were extremely cautious about it. And what they were even more cautious about was the creation of a third international, which they were being pressured into by the Bolsheviks. Because, you know, their feeling was, you know, Russia, you know, this is this backward country. I mean, they defended the Russian Revolution down the line. Rosa wrote some great articles in which she said, you know, yes, the Russian Revolution will be strangled in defeat, but it will be strangled above all by these cowardly social democrats who will just sit back and let it happen. I mean, that, she blamed the reformist leaders of Western European social democracy more than anybody for the isolation of the Russian Revolution. And she also, in one of her very last articles in the KPD daily newspaper, I mean, you just imagine, you know, it's a daily communist newspaper, and it was just one of 15 or 20 daily KPD newspapers all around Germany, just to show you the depth of the revolutionary sentiment at that particular time. One of her last articles says, in previous class wars throughout history, the opposing side entered battle under their own banners, class against class. But today, what we're seeing is the counter-revolution entering the battle under the flag of a German, of a social democratic party. If the question were posed clearly, capitalism or socialism, the great mass of German workers would have no doubts about what, which way they wanted to go. But we have entered this period in which no question can be posed clearly. Guy Debord quotes this passage in The Society of the Spectacle, if you recall. It's really one of the, a very powerful thing that she wrote. Rosa and Liebknecht were murdered 2 weeks later. street fighting started in Berlin, and the Freikorps didn't have too much trouble mopping up the communist people who were in the streets. It was there was no mass strike backing it up. It was it wasn't exactly like Occupy against the NYPD, but it was a pretty one-sided battle, because behind the Freikorps, who were actually, they were just paramilitary volunteers, but behind them was the German army and the police. It is interesting, however, that the chief of police of Berlin at this particular time after the revolution was a member of the USPD, and he actually helped, and he managed to keep the police off the backs of the communists for, I think he was ousted shortly after this. But, you know, it just shows what happens in revolution. You know, socialist in the government, a left social democrat as chief of police, and so on. Rosa and Liebknecht are hunted down, arrested, and they were murdered by the Freikorps in January 15th. So about 2 or 3 weeks after the creation of the KPD. And the repression came down very hard and continued for the next few months. And a number of other major figures were also assassinated in that period, including, see, did I put him on the list? Yes, the second name, Leo Jogisches. He was Rosa's partner for the better part of their adult lives. Also a very brilliant Polish Marxist revolutionary.
Gustav Landauer?
Sorry?
Gustav Landauer also?
Yes, but Gustav Landauer was an anarchist.
Yeah, I know.
I'm just. He wasn't in Berlin. He was in Munich.
In the south, right?
He was in Munich.
Yeah.
let me get to that. But I'm glad you mentioned it. He's a great, you know, he was a great firebrand, very good writer, very good revolutionary. But the tensions are developing between the Spartacus faction of the KPD and this IKD group from the Northwest with sympathizers elsewhere. And this is where it gets very murky. Now, what were the issues between them? One was Rosa wanted to participate in the parliamentary elections for the National Assembly in January 1919. The IKD said, we are not interested in elections. They were in agreement on breaking with the trade unions and seeing the trade unions as hopeless and irrecoverable. And again, above all, with all of them agreed that the question of forming a new international that would tend to fall under Russian control was something to be avoided at all costs. And this remained a sentiment in the KPD for at least a couple of years after the full, you know, after the revolution. Now, the rest of the history of the German Revolution is, I mean, I tried to hit, you know, the high points in this second page of this handout. But like I say, it really becomes a blur. And what's probably most striking about it is that there's one revolutionary insurrection after another all over the country, but never coordinated. Always in one city, always crushed in isolation. So, for example, as Idris was just mentioning, the Bavarian Soviet Republic was declared in April of 1919 with a lot of very brilliant anarchists and communist leaders, Gustav Landauer, Erich Mühsam, and others proclaiming this Bavarian Soviet Republic, but notice, for example, that Munich is right in the middle of one of the most densely Catholic and therefore conservative, I shouldn't say therefore, and conservative areas of Germany. And, you know, so it was kind of an extreme split between the city and the countryside. And within a week, the Bavarian Soviet Republic was isolated and crushed by, in this case, they didn't need to use paramilitary troops. I think they just, the army finished them off. Then in the spring of 1920, so this is now a year and a half after the revolution, the creation of the Communist Party, there's this very important event called the Kapp Putsch. Now, Kapp was some right-wing, K-A-P-P, some right-wing politician who was backed by a lot of these paramilitary elements as well as people in the army. And he staged a coup in Berlin and expected to, you know, the whole country would follow. But in fact, what happened instead was a general strike throughout all of Germany. And this is significant because it shows that even though it was a question of bringing, you know, basically what the result of the general strike was to bring back this wretched so-called socialist government, that the workers knew that these far-right elements behind Kapp were preparing a bloodbath against the working class, and the general strike was intended to stop that. Now, people have argued ever since about whether they should have pushed on for revolution or what exactly was expressed in that. But it was really the last time that there was a nationwide expression of working class hostility to the move to the right. One of the things I was talking briefly last week with Tom about this, it's just amazing how, I forgot to mention, this period from 1918 till Hitler took over in 1933 is referred to in German history as the Weimar Republic. It's called the Weimar Republic because the Constitution was written in the city called Weimar, which is on the map just a little bit south of, you know, it's not important. It's a small town. It's famous because that's where Goethe sort of held court. And it has a kind of cultural symbolism in Germany. But in the Weimar Republic, the entire judiciary remained the judiciary of the pre-1918 period, and therefore filled with judges who were monarchists and proto-fascists and so on, so that through this whole 15-year period, every time a right-wing, a cop, for example, I think he got 6 months in jail for trying to stage a coup. Every time a right-wing or far-right individual or group came before these courts, they would get a slap on the wrist, whereas any leftist involved in anything would either be sentenced to death or given a very long prison term. So it was a, right from the beginning, this Weimar Republic was a very shaky operation. I mean, in 1922, this very charismatic guy named Walter Rathenau, he was a Jewish businessman who was the foreign minister. And he was assassinated by a far-right terrorist group. And again, there were mass demonstrations all over Germany, probably some strikes and so on. And as far as I recall, the people who killed him were never arrested. And some of them, after World War II, reemerged as famous writers and things like that. It was just the whole just as one would expect in any capitalist bourgeois democracy, everything was tilted towards repressing the left and at best slapping the right on the wrist. Since I mentioned Rathenau, I want to go into another element of sort of geopolitics that played an important role. because of the Russian Revolution, this starts with a guy named Karl Radek, who is on this list. Karl Radek, like Rosa Luxemburg and Leo Jogiches, was a Pole, or maybe even a Lithuanian, but one of these people who spoke five languages, was active in the revolutionary movement all over Central and Eastern Europe. He came to Berlin as a Comintern emissary in early 1919, and a very talented guy, politically kind of all over the map. You know, one day he was sympathizing with the IKD, the next day he was sympathizing with somebody farther to the right. He was very quickly arrested, but it was an arrest like very few others, in which he basically held court in his prison cell in Berlin for several months. He was a very important guy, and he was very well known, not just in left-wing circles. And so for those 2 months, all kinds of top-level businessmen and military figures, as well as people from the left and the trade unions, were coming to Radek's cell. It was like a salon. And so Radek, of course, became kind of the expert on the German question for the Third International, for the Soviet government, and so on. And shortly after this, there was already a momentum for a kind of rapprochement between Germany and the Soviet Union, no matter who was in power in Germany. And this is really incredibly interesting. I don't think I should go off on in too much detail, but it's just so interesting that I want to say a few words about it. During the, you recall last time we were talking about the Red Army invaded Poland in the summer of 1920 with the hope of sparking a workers' revolt in Poland and being on the border of Germany when the German Revolution happened. And at this particular time, some members of the IKD were in Moscow, and they met Lenin. and Lenin pulled down a map of Germany and said, "So, comrades, our army will soon be on the eastern border of Germany. Where do you expect the revolt to break out first here in eastern Prussia?" And they all just kind of looked at each other because, you know, it would be like saying, "Where do you expect the revolution to start in Mississippi and Louisiana next week?" You know, it's the most conservative part of Germany. And this already gave the IKD people a certain sense that Lenin was a little out of touch with what was going on there. But the important thing is that as a result of these, of all this fighting that was going on, and, you know, not just on the Polish-German border, but also up here in the Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, and in Finland, where there was a vicious civil war going on between the Reds and the Whites, which the Whites unfortunately won with help from the Western powers. The German army, the German high command, was coming into contact with the Red Army and the top levels of the Red Army. And there's a very murky history that goes from 1919 right up to the Stalin-Hitler Pact of 1939 that these ties were really never broken. Now, in 1920, Germany made its first steps towards a kind of diplomatic rapprochement with the Soviet Union, which already was a slap in the face of the Allies. The Allies had imposed this treaty called the Versailles Treaty on Germany in the spring of 1919, a very draconian treaty, just unbelievable reparations. I think it was calculated that Germany would finish paying these reparations in 1950. The German army was restricted to 100,000 reservists, all kinds of cutting-edge factories and other equipment were shipped to the Western, to France and Britain. It was really a what they call a Carthaginian peace, where Germany was left with very little. And needless to say, this treaty was very unpopular, and the Social Democrats who signed it were further considered to be traitors. At first, they had knifed the German war effort in the back. Now they signed this horrendous treaty, and it was, in a sense, a lot of the leaders of the SPD were Jewish. It was very easy to play up the fact, here's a Jewish conspiracy selling out the country. It was right-wing propaganda right up to 1933 when Hitler took power, and Hitler tore up the Versailles Treaty. And he agitated against it through all those 15 years, along with everybody else on the right and the far right. And most of those reparations were never paid. So Germany and Russia begin to have diplomatic feelers. And the first thing that happens is that German industrialists are allowed to build factories in the Soviet Union. This is in 1920, while the Civil War is still going on. They were allowed to build make military equipment and other key materials that had military use. Now, I, of course, got interested in this. I looked into it a little bit. Some of the people on the German side actually traveled to Moscow and met with Lenin and Trotsky. And I have to say, as critical as I am of Lenin and Trotsky, I could not find any smoking guns. It was a very straightforward, pragmatic deal. We need this military equipment. You need some profits. So we're going to let you build these factories. But it was one of the ways in which these ties between the two governments began to be established. Around this time, there's a very colorful character named Colonel Max Bauer, who had excelled in crushing several working-class uprisings. He traveled to Moscow. He's met at a ceremonial dinner with Lenin and Trotsky. And further contracts are signed. And then Max Bauer goes on to China, where he becomes a consultant to Chiang Kai-shek, and the German, the Chinese Nationalist Party will be dealing with this next week. He's involved in crushing the communist workers in Shanghai and Guangzhou in 1927. So there's a kind of a set of relationships that are being set down here. And I don't want to draw any conclusions. I mean, some people think that this, already allowing German factories to be built in the Soviet Union was another step towards the emergence of the Soviet Union as a nation state that was pursuing nation state aims, and, to hell with the international movement. We can talk about that. But this was going on. In 1922, a formal agreement called the Treaty of Rapallo was signed, and the guy who engineered it on the German side was this guy Walter Rathenau, and for his trouble he was promptly assassinated by these far-right underground groups. It also is hard to keep a chronological narrative going because so much is going on all over the place. The Kapp Putsch happens in March of 1920. It fails because of this general strike. And in the Ruhr, which is the most industrial area of Germany, it's the true industrial heartland, if you want. There's an uprising that lasts for a week. And it results in the forming of what was known as the Red Army of the Ruhr, which was formed out of workers' militias. They even had a little air force. And they fought. Of course, the German army moved in very quickly. As I recall, it was a... yes. As a result, after the defeat of the Kapp Putsch, there was a social democrat who was concerned that the workers in the Ruhr area had never given in their weapons. They were still armed. And so there's some evidence that the initial incident that sparked, well, of course, the main incident was the Kapp Putsch, but this social democrat, he wanted the workers to rise up because they would be, he thought, they would be isolated, and they were, and therefore they could be easily... they could be relatively easily defeated. But it was quite a battle. It was probably the most extended armed confrontation of the whole revolution, in which thousands of workers were killed during the repression and, of course, afterwards, after they were rounded up. I was in Germany last fall, and I stopped off with this guy I know in the Ruhr, who's a kind of a historian, kind of a maniac who has 25,000 books in his library, but that's another story. And he knows a lot about this stuff. And I said, well, I'm looking around. nothing much of significance has happened in the Ruhr for a very long time. And he said, yes, it's very curious. There's a magnificent 3-volume study of the Ruhr Revolt. unfortunately not translated. I'm thinking of making a 20-page outline of it, but that's going to take a while. He said when this guy was writing this book, which was in the 70s, he came around and tried to find people who had experienced these events, and it was just almost forgotten. It was just like it never happened. He talked to people who had actually fought, and I mean, of course, a lot of the most class conscious and militant people had been killed, if not then, later, or during the Nazi period. But it was just like a historical amnesia, like you can't believe. Kind of, I guess, like, Vietnam today in the United States, and one person in 100 could say 5 interesting things about, what happened in Vietnam and why it happened and so on. That's a far-fetched analogy, but you get the idea. So the Ruhr uprising is crushed. And then after that, last week I mentioned the March action, March 1921. Now again, this is in central Germany. This is basically down here south of Berlin in another industrial area where also the workers had not given up their weapons after... the dust had settled in 1918-1919, and both the Communist Party and the Left Communists, the KAPD, I'm sorry, I forgot to mention that in fall 1919, the KAPD as a majority, left the KPD, or I think may even have been expelled, and formed the KAPD, which lasted only a couple of years as really a mass party. And when I say mass party, it was maybe 50,000 people or 100,000 people. I'd like to have a left communist group in the United States with 50 or 100,000 members. But, I mean, in Germany at that time, given all the other forces on the left and the right, it, you know, didn't have a lot of weight. But so they're both Kate, sorry. Tom has
no, he was talking.
Okay.
The ideological leaders of the KPD? Hmm? Can you list the ideological leaders of the KPD?
Well, let's see. Panikok, definitely. Okay. Gorder. But there were, you know, I think Panikok had been kicked out of Germany since he was a Dutch citizen. Okay. Gorder was in Holland. Probably the most interesting guy in the KPD at this point was a guy named Max Holtz, H-O-L-Z, who was a working class firebrand, incredible speaker, and great street fighter and strategist. And he kind of excelled in these kinds of confrontations, and he managed to, you know, play a leadership role in the March action, and then escaped to the Soviet Union and wrote an autobiography, which I haven't read, which is supposed to be, you know, really good about what happened.
Did he die in the trials too then? Or
sorry?
Did he die in the trials then? Or?
He died later, much later.
Okay.
I don't know in what circumstances. So the both the communists and the... Oh, sorry.
No, Tom. I was just letting you know he was raising his hand.
Okay. Anybody else have a question? both the KPD and the KAPD have troops, people on the ground in central Germany. and there's tremendous hesitation in both parties, actually, about the wisdom of an uprising at that time. And the great majority of workers in the immediate area, in fact, are hostile to the March action, which involves seizing some factories and, you know, with armed militias and getting ready to fight the police and the army. And in fact, the majority, even the great majority of workers, kind of held back. And so, once again, even though people like Max Holtz organized brilliant resistance for a couple of weeks, the uprising was crushed. I think 1,000 workers were killed. Many more were arrested and sent to jail for long terms. And there was much hand-wringing and accusation afterwards. interestingly, the head of the KPD, a guy named Paul Levy, who's mentioned, who was kind of a disciple of Rosa Luxemburg, but with none of Rosa's talents, he was opposed to the March action. And but it was kind of out of his control, and he wrote a pamphlet called Against Putschism. And he published it before the March action. And for his troubles, he was expelled from the KPD. Lenin actually privately agreed with Levy, but because he broke party discipline by publishing this pamphlet, you know, nothing was said. In the KAPD itself, there was a lot of criticism of the March action as well, that it was poorly prepared and isolated, and, you know, I think the term adventurous was used. So this was not really a sticking point between the two parties at that point. I mean, there was a lot of hesitation on both sides, and ultimately it was kind of an ill-considered action. And, you know, but further isolated the revolutionary elements on the left, and the left communists and the best people in the left wing of the Communist Party. So that was the spring of 1921. And as I mentioned last week, I really see that as kind of the turning point of the whole world revolution after World War I. Failure of the March action, the crushing of Kronstadt in Russia, Soviet Union, the Anglo-Russian trade agreement, which sort of normalized, it was the first time that relations were normalized with a capitalist country. The NEP, the New Economic Plan, which opened up the market to the peasants, which were, you know, they were 85% of the population. And then finally, also lesser known, the Soviet-Turkish commercial treaty, also of March 1921, in which Ataturk, the leader of the Turkish nationalists, was recognized and supported with Soviet money and weapons while he was crushing the Turkish Communist Party. You know, this would this was established a certain kind of precedent, which would be followed many times in the future. So it was just, while all none of these events were particularly coordinated, what they showed was a pulling back of the revolutionary wave. You know, the Trotsky said right after 1917, the world revolution is a matter of months. And then by 1921, I was saying, well, maybe it's a matter of years. And of course, Stalin moved in to this whole discussion saying, look, the world revolution is off the agenda. We've got to deal with our situation. And he launched this formulation, which I think I mentioned before, socialism in one country, something unheard of in the Marxist tradition up to that point. And so the ebb has kind of ended. Now, just let me add a couple of more points, and then we can get into our discussion. The situation in Germany was going from bad to worse. And some of you may recall the mass inflation of 1922-23 when German pensioners and other people were literally pushing their weekly pensions down the street in wheelbarrows in 1 billion mark notes that were being issued massively by the central bank. It was just the exchange rate between the mark and the dollar went from, you know, 4 or 5 in World War I up to 2 or 3 billion to 1 by 1922-23. I mean, it was just a chaotic situation. And workers were constantly striking, if for no other reason, because they had to keep up with inflation. And the workers didn't do too badly. The people who really got screwed were the middle class and pensioners who had bought all these war bonds during the war. And, you know, they would cash them in, and the money they would get back would buy a box of matches or, you know, pay for lunch or something like that. I mean, the life savings of the whole German middle class were wiped out. And also, all the debt of German industry was wiped out. So they came out of it very well. The working class didn't do too badly. It was the people who had no organizing strength who just got absolutely hammered by this inflation. So the situation was deteriorating, and there was this one last attempt at a revolution in the fall of 1923. There had been discussion of sending Trotsky to Germany to run the German Revolution the way he had run the Bolshevik seizure of power, but it never happened. I don't know what would have happened. But finally, in October of 1923, at the culmination of this crisis, there was Hitler's putsch in Munich, an attempt to seize the Munich government, which failed. And at the same time, a completely botched uprising in Germany. I think I mentioned last time that the Comintern analyzed the situation, decided to call it off, sent telegrams, and the guy with the telegram who was supposed to notify the Hamburg working class that the insurrection was off missed the last train. And so they rose up and they were crushed in isolation. And interestingly, as I point out at the very end here, the weapons that the German army used were from the Soviet Union. Not that the Soviet Union had sent them for this purpose, but they were weapons that were part of this deal in the German-Soviet rapprochement. Okay, I've talked too much, so why don't we move to questions and discussion and see what we can, you know, we can flesh this out more in terms of these different factions and what this means for today. I just one last thing. You know, again, it's the parallels and differences with contemporary China that I think are the most interesting aspect of, you know, why this stuff is not, you know, just ancient history for, you know, edification on a cold winter night.
Can you say a little more about the, maybe this is a very broad question, but about the class composition and maybe the changing class composition of Germany at this time, maybe between like 1889 and 1923, mm-hmm. and any of the like ethnic divisions of labor, like why were there so many Jews in the SPD and then also in the far left? And is that related to the division of labor?
Oh, yeah, sure. Okay. First of all, Germany was the most dynamic industrial country in the world at this time, with the exception of the United States. Around 1870, or at the latest, 1880, both Germany and the United States passed England as leading industrial powers. And in some ways, Germany's development was more interesting than the United States because it had this, you know, statist top-down element that I mentioned, you know, with Bismarck and so on. But it went much farther than that. For example, in 1870 in the United States, there were no graduate schools. If you wanted to go to graduate school in the 1870s and 1880s, and really up until the 1930s, you went to Germany, particularly in the sciences and in mathematics. And it wasn't just graduate schools. It was technical institutes that were innovating all kinds of stuff in engineering and steel production, chemistry, electronics, and so on. It was in that way the most advanced industrial country. And the United States was copying it madly, all these people coming back from studying there. I mean, none other than W.E.B. Du Bois went to graduate school in Germany between about 1908 and 1911, 1912. He took classes from sociologists like Max Weber. and just that's how widespread this fascination with Germany was. When the United States finally decided to have a central bank, which was created, the Federal Reserve Bank was created in 1913, it was copied from the German central bank. There were congressional studies over several years that we've got to have something like this. So Germany became this model. So in terms of class composition, it was a highly skilled workforce. Not only were there technical schools, I mean, to this day, for example, Germany has these apprenticeship programs that, you know, it's kind of, it's definitely a class-tilted kind of thing, sort of, you know, like tracking in the United States. Around the age of 16, if you're not going to go to the university, you go to one of these apprenticeship schools, or and it turns out, you know, hundreds of thousands of skilled workers in their late teens every year. So, you know, one of the reasons that today China and Germany have such close trade relations, with Germany exporting so much machinery and cars and equipment and so on to China, is because of this highly skilled workforce that, I mean, by comparison, the U.S. workforce just, how shall I say, pales in comparison. So there was this high level of labor formation. The real core industrial areas, as I mentioned earlier, the main one was over here in the Ruhr, the Ruhr area bordering on Holland, Belgium, and France. Bavaria was little industrialized. And then the area around Berlin and, I would say, and then Hamburg and Bremen, more kind of port-oriented, export-oriented, but with some industry. As for the class composition within this, there's no question that there was a division between these skilled workers who were relatively well-paid and a larger mass of unskilled workers, but As for breaking it down by industry or by region, I'm not really in a position to do that. In terms of ethnic division, there was a lot of Polish immigration into eastern Germany. A lot of Poles worked as agricultural laborers, and there was some anti-Polish feeling about that. Anti-Semitism in Germany was essentially aimed at the middle class. There were, to my knowledge, I mean, there was a huge Jewish working class in Poland, and in some and in some parts of Russia and other Eastern European countries. But to my knowledge, there wasn't much of a Jewish working class in Poland. But Jews were, you know, the anti-Semites played on the fact that Jews played a key role in banking and owned a lot of department stores and other things that were associated with modernization. Excuse me. I should just turn this off. But to my knowledge, anti-Semitism played next to no role in the working class itself. I mean, the Social Democrats, they just to flaunt their internationalism and their relative advance, as, progressive character, used to run Jewish, they went out of their way to run Jewish candidates in well-known right-wing anti-Semitic areas. And all of this was just kind of unheard of. You know, it was kind of like the rise of black politicians in the United States after the 60s. And it was just something that came as a result of some fundamental transformation of German society. But am I answering your question? Or?
I mean, I have more questions about it.
Okay, why don't we take some other questions from, we can come back to that.
I've read the, you have on the timeline, the Lenin's pamphlet, the letter of the communism. So I read the pamphlet once, but it was a long time ago. I know he's boxing with Pankow. I've been called infantile before. So, but what's the gist of the pamphlet? Are other folks
okay.
Read a lot? What's the nature of the debate?
I was thinking that, I mean, there's so much written about the German Revolution and all this stuff, and I was thinking, you know, it might have been a good idea, along with the Barrow, Otier, and the Bourinet chapters, to read Lenin's pamphlet, as well as Gorder's answer to the pamphlet, you know, which is also a brilliant pamphlet. The gist of Lenin, you know, Lenin wrote this in the spring of 1920. And the two targets in it are the German left communists, the KAPD, as well as the Dutch left, and the Bourdieists. Now, we can take this up, and actually maybe for our last session when we deal with left communism, we should read Lenin's pamphlet, you know, because it's a good introduction from the other side. You know, many years ago, I went to the library with that pamphlet, and I looked up all the people that Lenin was denouncing. I said, well, what do these people have to say? And that's kind of how I stumbled on to the left communist tradition, which, and at that time, of course, not much was published about it, and even to this to today, there's not a great deal that's published, but much more now. What Lenin was basically saying, you know, the argument was the model of the Russian Revolution is the model for a revolution in the West. And this was the process that Rosa Luxemburg had been so worried about, that that by the very nature of being the only country with a ostensibly Marxist party in power, that they would take over the Third International. And even though it was obvious to everyone, including the Bolsheviks, that Germany as a working class was much more important and more powerful than the Russian working class. But what Lenin was trying to hammer home, what he was calling, you know, this infantile sectarian quality of the Western European left communists for their refusal to enter into alliances with other forces. And this involved at different times that the I believe it was the third Congress. At the third Congress, 1921, the KABD was expelled from the Third International. And they set up a new international with some other left communist forces centered in Amsterdam, which unfortunately only lasted a couple of years. And Trotsky made a speech. This was after Kronstadt. He said, "We hear a lot of talk these days about the need for a third revolution, you know, i.e. a revolution against the Bolsheviks. Well, if we're going to have a third revolution, why not a fourth international? Surely being overwhelmed by numbers will not be the problem of a fourth international if one day such an organization is ever founded." You know, it's one of Trotsky's many prophecies that wind up applying to himself. But Lenin was trying to do, what the real core of it, as I recall, was the question of the United Front. Now, what does the United Front mean? The term has been used and abused ever since. But at that time, it meant essentially align with the Social Democrats or the left-wing Social Democrats. Like, for example, you see here, I think I barely touched on it, that ultimately, and I did mention that ultimately the KPD fused with the majority of the USPD and founded that's what became the mass Communist Party. That was in 1921, I believe. Oh, sorry, 1920. And Bordiga down in Italy was polemicizing all this time about the dangers of absorption of the left-wing Social Democrats, most of whom, not just in Italy, but everywhere in Europe, had supported their own country in World War I. And in fact, there's a very nice continuity between left Social Democrats who voted for war credits for their own bourgeoisie, who would in the left wing of the Socialist parties after the war, and who became Stalinists 5 years later. So there's a certain kind of logic in their evolution. And Bordiga was adamant. You know, the Comintern ordered the Italian Communist Party, you've got to fuse with the left wing of the socialists. And Bordiga said, no way. So that's how he gets into this pamphlet. But he's really not mentioned that much. The real force of Lenin's polemic is aimed at the KAPD and the Dutch left communists for their infantile refusal to make alliances with other forces. Now, in his reply, Hermann Gorder, who was, along with Pannekoek, one of the two most important leaders of the Dutch left, he wrote this open letter to Comrade Lenin, which you can find on LibCom. And it's really quite remarkable. I mean, in retrospect, it all seems very obvious. But you know, here's this guy, who, you know, a poet, not really that well known outside of Holland and Germany, taking on Lenin, who was at the height of his prestige in 1920. Say, look, Lenin, what you've got to understand is that the revolution in Russia triumphed because you had the support of the peasantry. The peasantry didn't love you. They were suspicious of you. You stole the whole program of the left wing of the socialist revolutionaries by agreeing to the seizure of land in 1917, as if the Bolsheviks had any choice about that. But, you know, the peasants seized the land and handed it out among themselves, which was not the Bolshevik program. The Bolshevik program was nationalization of the land and the creation of collective farms voluntarily. But nevertheless, those were the circumstances, and that was what neutralized the peasantry in the Civil War. No matter what the whites tried to do, they could never convince the peasantry that they weren't going to bring back the landlords, which is exactly, of course, what they intended to do. So the alliance between, the hammer and sickle. What is the hammer and sickle? It's a symbol of the alliance of the working class and the peasantry. But this was not on the agenda in Western Europe. In Western Europe, it was, in Gorder's words, the working class stands alone and cannot ally with any other political force. Now, one might say, I think it's right, that in some cases the revolutionary working class party could say to, say, peasant smallholders and landless workers in the countryside, you've got to recognize capitalism is headed for large-scale capitalist agriculture. It's going to wipe you out. We offer you, as a doomed social class, we offer you the best possible way out. And on that basis, you could make an alliance. But to ally with, above all, with the social democrats who had just drowned the revolution in blood a couple of years earlier in Germany and were getting ready to do so in other places, this was just something that the many communists as well as left communists just could not swallow. And that's what Lenin was trying to hammer away back. But the real issue in both the case of Bordiga and the Dutch left was to say that this dual revolution, revolution, proletarian revolution in the cities, bourgeois revolution in the countryside, land to individual peasant smallholders, that this was the model for world revolution. This is where the Russian dominance of the international really, you know, made itself felt most forcefully. You know, because from that point on, nobody could argue with the Russian party and the Russian state, you know, which was using the Third International as one aspect of its foreign policy. So that's a thing. But I think when we get to the left communists in our final meeting, we should definitely read Lenin's pamphlet and maybe, you know, that and Gorder's reply, something like that.
Just to what switched the line then, right? Since after Stalinization of the party in Germany, then they had an anti-social democratic line.
Oh, okay.
The Nazis.
Yeah, I made noises last week about carrying this whole story up to the seizure of power of Hitler, but I really think, you know, we've covered enough ground today. Maybe we can deal with that.
Okay.
But you know, to put it very briefly, right after the events that I was talking about in 1923, the last uprising in Hamburg, Hitler's failed push, Germany stabilized for 4 years, along with the rest of the capitalist world. As a result, the different extreme parties kind of, you know, went into the woodwork. Then came the 1929 crash, which hit Germany harder than any other country except the United States. In both Germany and the U.S., there was about 30 to 35% unemployment at the depths of the Depression in 1932. But in that period, starting in 1928, okay, I'll try to make this as brief as possible. 1924 to 1928, the period of stabilization, was a period of, you know, we refer to 1928 to 1933 as the third period. Nobody says the first period or the second period, but the first period was up to Lenin's death, 1924, the events we've been talking about. The second period, a term also nobody uses, is the period of the stabilization. The most important event going on at that time was the defeat of the Chinese Revolution, ultimately in 1927. It was a period in which Bukharin and the Bukharin right, as we discussed was it last week or the previous week, was more or less calling the shots in Comintern policy. So there were people in all countries who oriented towards the Bukharinist right, who were running the communist parties, trying to make alliances with progressive elements of the bourgeoisie. It was sort of a dress rehearsal for the Popular Front of the 30s. 1928, Stalin has defeated Bukharin and Trotsky, has defeated the Trotskyists, has defeated the left. He turns on Bukharin and shifts over to what actually was called the third period, the period of class against class, which meant the social democrats are fascists, or to use the term at that time, social fascists. They're more dangerous than the actual fascists. And in a number of countries like China and Vietnam, the Communist Party set off into these really adventurous kinds of actions with the slogan Soviets everywhere. That's why, you know, it was referred to as a kind of an ultra-left period. And this had serious implications nowhere more than in Germany, where you have this mass social democratic party, had a significant communist party. By that time, the left communists had faded away. And this rising Nazi party. And for all this period, from 28 to 33, the Communist Party was directing its fire against the Social Democrats. And actually, you know, in some, for example, I believe it was in 1932, the Social Democrats were running the state government in Prussia, and the tramway workers went on strike in Berlin. Communists and Nazis together picketed in support of that strike. And this happened in a number of places around the country. They were, you know, they were both out to torpedo the Social Democrats. They did, successfully. The German Communist Party's slogan was, "After Hitler, us." And that was their line. And even in 1934, when they were in the concentration camps in their underground newsletters, they were still peddling this third period line that the Social Democrats were more dangerous than the than the Nazis. So it didn't end well. Now, in some sense, you could say that after Hitler us became was verified when the Communist Party got East Germany after the Red Army invaded in 1945, but that was not the plan. And so that's kind of what makes the final link between these earlier. I mean, nothing much of importance happened in the so-called second period, but the third period was just an absolute disaster. And many, just one sec, many social democratic and communist workers at the base wanted to work together. They knew this was madness. And they, in some places, committees were established. Trotsky on his island off the coast of Turkey is issuing these pamphlets, which are read by a few hundred people, calling for a united front from below, you know, to fight against the fascists. But it had almost no effect.
It was adventurism that made the switch, though, you think more? It was like, it this class against class line, and that's what made this that made them take up that, because it just seems so crazy, right? Like,
well, it was,
it's hard to see the rationale.
Yeah, but, you know, it's like, let's see, just imagine some, you know, just imagine some situation arose here in which some part of the serious left was called upon to ally with Obama liberals. I mean, that was the way in which German communists felt about the SPD. The SPD had crushed the revolution from 1918 to 1923. They had brought the Freikorps into Berlin and killed Rosa Luxemburg. It wasn't difficult to portray them as reactionaries, but no distinction was made between the SPD leadership and a lot of SPD workers who were in the SPD for all kinds of historical reasons and, you know, certainly did not buy into, you know, these crimes of the leadership. But it was just historically, it was just too late to win over enough people to the idea of uniting against the fascists. Yes.
It kind of related to that. Like, what was the? Maybe this, I don't know if this is a question that makes sense. But like, how are they organizing? Like, how are the left communists organizing the working class? Like, did they have implantations? Were they just saying like what was their relationship in attempting to change the consciousness of SPD workers? Or were they just like, oh, you have this party affiliation, so forget you. Like, what were the workers and the rank and file of the party doing?
Okay, unfortunately, that's over here in this part that kind of got cut off when I was photocopying. But, and as I said, I don't really know enough about the AAUD, the AAUDE, et cetera, these different groups that were generally attacked as syndicalists, whether they were or not. that was what, you know, the slogan of the KPD and later the KAPD was out of the parliament, out of the unions. And, you know, because the unions were directly involved in crushing the revolution under social democratic leadership. So then, of course, the KAPD, or the KPD, after Lenin cracked down and after they sort of decided to go along with a general line of the Third International, they went back to both parliamentary activity as well as the unions. But the left communists generally tried to form independent organizations that they refer to as, they use the German word Union, which does not mean union in German. They presented it as an organization that synthesized the political party with the workplace struggle group, essentially. And I don't know that any of them were terribly successful. I mean, maybe 50 or 100,000 people participated in these different groups, and they might have been important for a year or two. But the after the KAPD left the KPD in 1919, they just never really got it together. I mean, whether or not it was a question of not having a centralized party, I don't know. But they just couldn't crystallize a pole. I mean, after all, the revolution was ebbing on a world scale. It was ebbing in Germany. There was defeat after defeat, which neither the KPD or the KAPD could do much about. And I think I don't know that the KAPD's ideas were ever really tested in any prolonged period. I think they were too much a creation of this immediate revolutionary situation, and once that situation ended, you know, there just wasn't much left of it. But it's an important question, and I wish I could say more about it. But I think that's the general idea. I mean, if you look in the further chapters of that book by Bourinet, he has a whole history of what happened to the the KAPD and the other left communists, both in Holland and Germany, after the defeat, when they retreated into being essentially small sects. And one of the important points that he makes is that Gorder and Panikkak in the very early 20s were absolutely not anti-party. They wanted to have a communist party. They just didn't want the Moscow-Leninist version of the Communist Party. Later, with the kind of councilists who emerged in the late 20s, early 30s, people like Paul Maddox Sr., who's a very serious Marxist theoretician, they sort of invented this idea of councilism that in which the need for the Communist Party just disappeared. So that's an important distinction that emerged later.
You know, like Adorno said that in Nazi Germany, no praxis was possible. You know, I'm wondering to what extent any of these organizations were able to keep even the most minimal presence after the ascent of Hitler. And second part of that question, was there any reconstitution after the fall of the Third Reich, or was everybody dead by then?
Okay, very interesting. The Communist Party maintained an underground organization in Germany throughout the Hitler period. I mean, most of them were either in concentration camps or in exile, but some people in Germany managed to form an underground of sorts. I don't recall that it had any great successes, but for example, in 1943, when the Great Britain and the United States had begun a serious bombing of Germany, there's a famous episode where a German countess, some aristocratic woman who had fled the Nazis, was living in London, ran into Winston Churchill at a cocktail party and said, "So, how is the bombing of Germany going?" And Churchill says, oh, great, and tonight we're hitting Hamburg and Bremen, and we're going to be bombing above all the working class neighborhoods where the Communist Party has its strong its strongholds. So one aspect of World War II that you rarely read about is the way in which on both sides, the Nazis and the Allied powers, they were focused on avoiding a repetition of what happened in 1918. the Allied bombing of Germany was aimed at working class neighborhoods. It was not aimed at factories. They wanted to paralyze production, so they bombed the workers instead of the factories. At the end of the war, 80% of all German industry was still intact. What had been bombed were the working class neighborhoods and bridges and railroads to prevent movement of goods and people. meanwhile, the German Social Democrats, I'm sure they had their underground organization, but they were in exile in places like Britain, where they were being cultivated for the post-war period. And so when the war ended, the Russians came in the east, and they quickly put pro-Moscow communists in power, and the rest of the country was divided between a French, an American, and a British occupational zones, and the intelligence agencies of both Britain and the United States were busy setting up anti-communist, social democratic unions and political offices and things like that, as well as getting all the Nazi war criminals out of the country and to South America where they could play a counterinsurgency role later on. It was really a very pretty picture. The anticipation of it. Oh, and I forgot to mention the Gestapo, the German secret police, also was very concerned about a repetition of 1918, and they were following what was going on in the working class very carefully with this in mind. There's a British historian named Tim Mason who has written a series of books about, based on the Gestapo files, about what was going on in the working class and how, even though there was generally quiet and not that many strikes, although there were strikes under the Nazis, they were just handing in weekly reports on what was going on in all the key industrial zones. And then finally, actually, somebody else has found material on, kind of youth gangs in the working class that emerged during the war that would go around at night, writing anti-Nazi slogans and, carrying out low-level sabotage and stuff like that.
That's Bologna's take, right?
Bologna, I think, Bologna. But Bologna also writes about the whole working class during under the Nazis as well. But it was absolutely not a clear, cut and dried picture of repression. the Nazis knew very well that they had to keep the workers as happy as possible after shutting down the unions, shutting down the SPD and the KPD. Real wages rose significantly in Germany starting in about 1936. there were some strikes in kind of chokehold places where the Nazis had to settle. That's broadly speaking the picture. After the war, under the Soviet occupation, the KPD leaders returned from the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. They set up a Stalinist regime in what became East Germany. The different occupying powers in the West were setting up, they were using the Social Democrats. The Communist Party was legal in the three Western occupied zones until, I believe, 1956. It was getting about 10% of the vote, but it was nothing like didn't have the influence that it had from before the war. There was a great episode as the Soviet army was coming into Berlin. They were freeing people from prisons and things like that, and they they freed the inmates of a mental asylum. And one of the inmates was a veteran of the 1918 revolution who somehow got to a print shop and had these huge posters printed up declaring a republic of Soviets and workers' councils, and you know, plastered them all over Berlin. And you know, the Red Army and the Communist Party were going somewhat crazy trying to figure out, you know, what this was, but ultimately nothing came of it. That's about the picture.
Quick follow-up. So what was the leadership situation? Since the Communist Party was underground, and it sounds like a lot of these strikes and kind of diffusive acts of resistance where it had to be conducted in secrecy, was there a less formal leadership? Was it more just spontaneous self-activity behind the strikes and the youth gangs? Or was there still a kind of like rigid and various structure of all these different groups and ideologies that there had been prior to the war?
Well, for example, in the concentration camps, the KPD, which had the best organizational experience, they very often became the capos in the concentration camps. The capos were like enforcers of the German prison guards and military. And there was a lot of settling of scores between different factions by these people. So there's one case in which party discipline was maintained. I frankly don't know. I would think that in the conditions of the underground, things were not terribly well coordinated, you know, because people were being picked up all the time and the cells were extremely isolated from each other. There is one interesting case of Alfred Sohn Ratel, who some of you may know. He wrote a really interesting book on mental and manual labor. Member of the Frankfurt School. He also wrote a book about the Nazi economy. He was employed when Hitler took over by one of the big industrial firms in Berlin. And he was totally underground as a communist. And he managed to continue that job for 3 years into the Nazi period. And he was essentially putting out a newsletter for the company on the financial and economic situation. And so he had access to virtually everything that was going on. So while he was putting out his newsletter for the company, he was also writing for the underground communist press, driving the Gestapo absolutely crazy as these brilliant analyses of the week-to-week developments at the top levels of German banks and corporations were appearing in the communist press. But they finally figured out who it was. Fortunately, Sohn Ratel was able to escape, fled to Britain. But by and large, I mean, the Social Democrats, I think they survived essentially with the support of the United States and above all with the British. They were being groomed to return and reestablish themselves at the expense of the communists, being helped by the Allied air forces who were destroying the communist strongholds and the big cities. At that end, it was well coordinated. Somebody like Willy Brandt, for example, who became chancellor of Germany in 1969, he was a SPD. He was actually to the left of the SPD, but was in exile during the war, and he was one of these people who was groomed by Western intelligence for a role in German politics after 1945. I can't remember the details, but during the Watergate hearings of 1974-75, it was exposed that he was being paid by the CIA the whole time. He was the mayor of Berlin through most of the 60s. So that's how he kind of moved up and moved out. Any more questions? Or?
In the reading, Rosa Luxemburg was talking about Lenin and the critiques of each other, and there was one thing she said about, or the writing said about, Luxemburg's intentions were wrong, but her outcome was correct, and Lenin's intentions were correct, but his outcomes were incredibly wrong.
Which of the...
I'm paraphrasing.
Oh, okay.
It's the reading that you said you didn't want to be sent out. It was the most recent one you sent out.
The most recent or the first one?
The most recent.
Okay. So, and who was saying that her intentions were wrong, but her...
Rosa, it said the way she went about it was wrong, but her outcome was correct. The way she wanted things to end, or how...
In terms of the creation of the KPD?
In terms of her relations with Lenin, the critiques they had going back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that would be somebody who would be sympathetic to Lenin, but kind of recognizing that in the long run, Rosa was right. Was possibly on the national question?
It's possible, I'm not really sure.
Okay, without a clear idea of what exactly the people were referring to, I'm not sure I understand the question, or I don't recall the passage. But there's no question that Rosa was right, that well, so much happened after the battle between Lenin and Luxemburg in terms of party organization that it's really hard to blame Lenin for Stalinism. I mean, full-blown Stalinism. I mean, there was authoritarian aspects of Lenin's conception of the party, but it was nothing like what it became under Stalin. So somebody is saying that Rosa was right in criticizing Lenin's view of the party, and that was proved to be so... later on. I mean, I'm sure that's not what you're referring to, but
yeah,
that would be an example of it. Or I'm sorry, I'm just not without... But I did want to mention the first book I sent out by Barreau and Autier, who read those chapters? Okay. And the second thing that I sent out by the one on the German and Dutch left by Bourinet, who read those? Okay. I had totally forgotten that Bourinet's book was available in English. And he actually sent me, I contacted him, and he sent me that copy, which, as I emphasize, please do not forward. And God forbid, don't put it online. It's about to come out as a book. but it's just seems to me much more balanced. I mean, the thing that really raised my eyebrow with the Barreau-Autier book was when, they just have almost contempt for Rosa Luxemburg.
That's the Deve one you're talking about.
Hmm?
That's the Deve text. Okay,
yeah.
All right, yeah.
Right. Yes, Rosa Luxemburg was on the right wing of the debate in the newly founded Communist Party. Why? Because she wanted to participate in the elections for the National Assembly, and maybe on one or two other questions, whereas the IKD, the hard left communists, no parliament, no unions, etc. Okay, she's on the right. But Rosa Luxemburg was just this towering figure of the revolutionary movement up to that point. I mean, she was killed 2 months after the revolution. She didn't really have time to develop a thorough position on a lot of these questions. Maybe she would have continued in that that direction, but she was extremely suspicious of Lenin and the Bolsheviks and what they would do with a communist international once that was created, and the kind of contemptuous dismissal in Barreau. Barreau is, as I said, is the pseudonym of Gilles Deve. I'd kind of forgotten about that, so that's how I got a hold of Bourinet's book, and which I think it's just much more balanced and much more favorable towards recognizing Luxembourg's role, even though Borini himself agrees with the left communists that she was wrong in those formulations in the last couple of months of her life. So and basically, but we'll get into this in the meeting on left communism. Barreau and Oche at that point, so far as I know, still are coming from a very hard Bordigas position. And actually, I think they go farther than Bordiga. I mean, Bordiga himself had great respect for Rosa Luxemburg, even though he too agreed with the left communists. But he recognized that she had been a towering figure. and it's the Bordigas attitude towards democracy that is really what is behind the way in which Barreau and Ortier just kind of dismiss Rosa Luxemburg. You know, I mean, Bordiga's formulations about democracy are, well, how shall I say, they leave something to be desired, particularly in light of everything that happened with Stalinism. But, you know, Bordiga, most of those writings were in the late teens and early 20s before anybody had ever heard. I mean, Bordiga considered fascism to just be an episode of bourgeois rule that was not that different from any other one. And he considered Stalin's greatest crime was that he was a Proudhonist. You know, when you see how it works out, it makes some sense. But, you know, just... You know, those classic writings of Bordiga were all done before the fascism or Stalinism had really morphed into what they ultimately became. Now, maybe he would have said the same thing at this later. I don't know. But so, even though there's a lot of valuable material in the Barreau-Ottier book, I think the Bourine book is much. It's just much more balanced.
I got a question.
Yeah.
Like, there was this, like, point that I heard, like, a lot of... I think it was, like, around the discourse of people thinking about, like, what could make permanent revolution in 1917. They were like, specifically making the point that Germany needs to have its revolution. So I was just wondering why. Is it because the class composition of Germany? Is it just to have another country? Why specifically?
Who was writing this? And
I think the Bolshevik Party was specifically saying, like, Germany needs to have a revolution so we can bring in a worldwide scale. And why Germany specifically?
Well, that was the centerpiece of the Bolshevik strategy. Mm-hmm. You know, they always were saying, we're back where, you know, Lenin once made a speech, you know, what is the Soviet Union? This was 1921 or so. He said, the Soviet Union is a backward country with a pro-working class communist party in power. What will the Soviet Union be after the German Revolution? It will be a backward country with substantial aid from our fraternal communist government or communist government in Germany. In other words, they had no illusions about Russia being anything but sort of advance action in this much wider battle where the center was Germany. I mean, that's why.
Why Germany, besides anybody else?
Because it was the most powerful industrial country. I mean, their idea, and it was the idea of Rosa Luxemburg and the German communists as well. After a German revolution, German industry would be able to help the development of the Soviet Union in a way that would never happen if Russia just had to deal with a lot of capitalist powers. I mean, it was just the strategically most important country. And if there had been a revolution in Germany, there probably would have been a revolution in half a dozen other countries as well. Mm-hmm. We would be living in communism by now. I mean, all other things being equal. But, yeah. Anyone else? Okay. I hope I didn't talk too much. Next week, let's do Maoism. The reading for that, I will suggest, is the article which I wrote about 9 months ago, almost a year ago, called Notes Towards a Critique of Maoism. And Shimon is going to come up with a one of the 200 replies, most of them hostile. He's going to choose one of the more intelligent ones, and we'll read that for a kind of balance. And so we'll deal with Maoism a week from today. And then I unfortunately will be out of town the following Sunday. That's that's the weekend of the 29th and 30th, so I hope that we can just have a vacation and meet the following week to deal with left communism as such, particularly the German, Dutch, and Italian variants of that. And then Shimon asked me to explain where I come down on all these questions. I mean, you probably can get some pretty clear idea of that from what I've said about these other countries, et cetera. But so that'll kind of wind things up. And, you know, people want to continue on other subjects, that's fine with me. But, this was the original plan. So, Cindy, did you want to?
Thanks, Can you add me to the list?